Hello, and welcome to our program Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First up, 13 Things. Here's High-Flying Facts About Drones, collected by Mark Sossman of Reader's Digest. Number 1. Unmanned aerial vehicles may seem like recent technology, but the earliest version took flight back in 1849 during the First Italian War of Independence. An Austrian artillery lieutenant, Franz von Eustachius, used pilotless balloons packed with explosives to attack Venice. He was mostly unsuccessful. Some balloons even blew back to Austria. Number 2. Abraham Karam, also known as the Drone Father, built the first modern drone in the 1970s. He went on to design the MQ-1 Predator drone for the United States military, which fired its first missile over Afghanistan in October 2001. Today, drones are being used in the Russia-Ukraine war for surveillance and recon. Combat drones have struck both Moscow and Kyiv, but drones have also dropped food and supplies to Russian-occupied territories in Ukraine. Number 3. Military drones resemble small airplanes and can cost more than $15 million apiece. But many versions, sometimes called quadcopters, look more like tiny helicopters and are available for anyone to buy for as little as $40. Most are remotely operated via either a controller or a smartphone app, but some models can fly autonomously thanks to GPS, sensors, and cameras that help them avoid obstacles. Number 4. You'll need to be at least 16 years old and register your drone with the Federal Aviation Administration before your aircraft can join the roughly 1 million drones in the U.S. One exception, toy drones weighing less than half a pound. The FAA also requires users to maintain sightline, typically 1.5 miles with binoculars. Night flying requires a waiver and FAA approval. It's the top request among recreational drone flyers, usually to capture shots of cities lit up against the dark sky. Number 5. GPS tracking prevents drones from entering no-fly zones like airports and government facilities. When a drone reaches the boundary of such an area, it will either turn around and go back to its user, or it will automatically land itself. If a drone has been illegally modified to enter no-fly zones, authorities can shoot it down or electronically jam it so that it falls out of the sky. Its user could face a hefty fine or even imprisonment. Number 6. When it comes to flying a drone over private property, state laws vary, but the property's residents always have a right to privacy. If you believe you're being recorded by a drone, contact police. It's a felony to shoot down a drone, even if it's hovering over your property. In the year 2020, Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, filed a lawsuit against paparazzi for flying a drone above their California backyard and capturing photos of their son. The agency responsible agreed to turn over the photos and never again traffic in photos of the family taken by similar means. Number 7. The National Association of Realtors reports that adding drone footage to your real estate listing could help sell your home 68% faster, perhaps because aerial shots allow prospective buyers to see not just the home itself, but also the surrounding neighborhood. Number 8. People now race drones as they do cars, but at far faster speeds. Some can go from 0 to 90 miles per hour in less than 1 second. The first World Drone Prix was held in Dubai in the year 2016. A teen from the United Kingdom grabbed the $250,000 grand prize after maneuvering his drone through 12 laps of the nearly half-mile-long course the fastest. Number 9. Using cameras, along with sensors that detect body heat, search and rescue drones can help locate missing people and animals trapped in hard-to-reach areas, such as under rubble in the aftermath of a natural disaster, as was the case in Turkey following the magnitude 7.8 earthquake in 2023. Conservationists and researchers are also now using drones to monitor endangered species and to catch poachers of elephants and rhinoceroses in Botswana, Malawi, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. Number 10. Sometimes, though, it's the crooks who are flying the drones. Last year, 20 people were arrested in a scheme that involved using drones to smuggle drugs, weapons, cash, and cell phones into Lee Correctional Institution in Bishopville, South Carolina. Number 11. One day soon, a drone may deliver your online order. Last November, the FAA approved its first-ever delivery drone for urban areas. Amazon is one of the biggest companies to test drone deliveries, but there are others too, such as DHL, Google, UPS, and Walmart. In fact, Walmart made 6,000 drone drops last year in 7 states for those who signed up to beta test the service. Number 12. Not only are drones an environmentally friendly delivery method, most small drones are powered by batteries, but they can help the planet in other ways too. A Canadian startup called Flash Forest is helping to reforest areas of the country that have been devastated by wildfires by deploying drones that drop tree seed pods across landscapes too dangerous for humans to traverse. And finally, number 13 of high-flying facts about drones in Reader's Digest. Could drones that fly us be next? The first passenger drone was unveiled in the year 2016 by Ehang, a Chinese company, but is still going through rigorous testing. Perhaps one day we'll take one to work and fly over rush hour traffic without needing a pilot's license. Next in Reader's Digest, drama in real life. Doctors said there was slim hope for the baby born with only half a heart, but her father had just begun to fight. Robert Keener writes A Marine's Toughest Battle in Reader's Digest. It seemed so real, thought Rob Velez, about the dream he'd had the night before. Lying in bed after waking from a long night's sleep in his home outside London, he smiled as he remembered the wonderful scene. In it, he had been holding his newborn daughter in his strong arms. As she looked lovingly into his eyes, he was so overcome with emotion that the tough 50-year-old former U.S. Marine had started crying. He was in love. He'd never felt this much love for anyone. Amazing, he thought, as the morning sun streamed through his windows. This was more than a dream. He threw back his covers and put on some clothes. He had to tell his partner of 4 years, Zofia Fenrick, what he had learned from his dream. Fenrick, a 40-year-old homeopathic therapist, listened to him as he told her about his dream. You're pregnant. We're having another baby. Fenrick laughed. They had a 2-year-old daughter, and both had 16-year-old sons from previous relationships. No way I'm pregnant, she said. Honey, he said, we are having a little girl. I saw her, and she'll be beautiful. To prove it, Velez zipped downstairs to the pharmacy to get a pregnancy test kit. An hour later, 2 red lines appeared on the test strip. Fenrick was indeed pregnant. She screamed in delight, and the couple embraced. We're going to have a beautiful daughter, Velez said. I know. I saw her last night. 4 months later, in February 2022, they went to the doctor's office for an ultrasound. They held hands as the sonographer moved an electronic probe called a transducer over Fenrick's abdomen. A 2-dimensional image of their baby, whom they had already named Dorothea, appeared on the screen. We saw her tiny fingers and toes and watched as baby Dorothea, my dream daughter come true, actually moved, Velez remembers. She was sucking her thumb. Then both of us let out a shout as it looked like she waved at us. She was so tiny, so beautiful. Suddenly, the sonographer stopped moving. We have a problem, she said. She called in a pediatric expert from a nearby hospital. An hour later, after studying the sonogram, the expert dropped a bomb. I am so sorry, she said. She explained that the baby had hypoplastic left heart syndrome, HLHS, a rare, often fatal condition. Dorothea had only half a heart. The rest was undeveloped, and because of that, she had little chance of surviving. Her best advice was that we elect to, and I'll never forget the word, quote-unquote, terminate the pregnancy, says Velez, choking back tears. This was the moment that everything, our entire lives, changed forever. Never. That was the word both Velez and Fenric used when they heard the doctor's advice to have an abortion. Forget about it, Velez shouted at the pediatrician. After digesting the news, Dorothea's parents decided to enjoy every day they had with her. They took day trips to the seaside and visited nearby parks, where they would walk for hours and keep up a steady conversation with their unborn baby, explaining what they were doing and seeing. On one trip to a botanical garden, as their 2-year-old Bathsheba screamed with joy while she chased ducklings, Fenric caressed her own belly and told Dorothea, "See, your sister is having so much fun." At home, Fenric would play the piano, her son would play the violin, and Bathsheba would sing to her unborn sister. "We wanted to include Dorothea in everything," remembers Fenric. Velez, who had been stationed in England as a Marine and had moved back there for his job with a global financial services company in the year 2014, was now employed at a private equity firm that worked with healthcare startups. He pulled every string he could to get a second opinion, only to hear the same diagnosis and the same suggested medical path to take: terminate the pregnancy. Obsessed with saving his daughter's life, Velez quit his job and devoted all his time to researching HLHS. He and Fenric dipped into their savings to survive. He wrote countless messages to doctors, surgeons, specialists, and hospitals around the world, hoping to find someone who could help. A fetal echocardiogram at 24 weeks revealed even more bad news. In addition to HLHS, Dorothea also had a severe blockage in her heart. Their baby had only a 5% chance of survival, Velez and Fenric were told. Then they found out about a risky in utero fetal operation that might be able to repair her heart. No one in the UK could carry out the complex surgery, so Velez and Fenric looked elsewhere, eventually locating a pediatric surgeon in Texas who agreed to perform the procedure, but it would cost the couple more than $3 million. Hoping to raise the money, they started a publicity campaign, giving countless interviews to the press. Velez also sent scores of emails to celebrities and, as he remembers, every billionaire I could think of. But they raised only about $60,000, far from what they would need. As the days ticked by, their chances of saving their unborn baby's life looked more and more hopeless. Look closer. It was in the middle of the night when Velez heard the voice in his head. He was sitting alone in his home office, despairing that he'd failed his family. "Am I going crazy?" he thought. "Now I'm hearing voices." "Look closer," the voice repeated. "What are you talking about?" he answered out loud. "I've tried everything." "Look closer to home." "Fine," thought Velez. "I'll try again." He Googled, quote-unquote, impossible cases, quote-unquote, miracle surgeon, quote-unquote, UK pediatric expert, and, quote-unquote, HLHS. Almost immediately, a link to a Facebook page about Guido Michelon, a cardiothoracic surgeon, popped up in the search results. Velez poured through the Facebook page, reading message after message from enthusiastic parents thanking Dr. Michelon for, quote-unquote, saving our baby's life, quote-unquote, giving us hope, quote-unquote, changing our lives, and more. Even more remarkable, Velez discovered that the Italian-born surgeon was an expert in HLHS and had done more than 2,000 open-heart procedures with a special focus on neonatal surgeries. How did I miss him? Velez wondered as he wrote an email to the London-based surgeon describing Dorothea's issues and including medical notes and copies of her sonograms. Within hours, he got a reply. I am in Italy now, but will be back this Friday. I've moved you to the top of my appointment list. 5 days later, at the end of a long Skype conference call, Dr. Michelon gave the anxious parents the news they'd been praying for. I can help you. I will operate on Dorothea after she is born and stabilized. He explained that he hoped to basically, quote-unquote, rewire and, quote-unquote, rebuild her heart and veins several days after she was born. And instead of costing millions, the operation, called the Norwood Procedure, would be fully covered by the UK's National Health Service, or NHS. Velez and Fenwick were ecstatic, but they were jolted back to reality when the surgeon warned, a child with HLHS has a very low chance of survival, and Dorothea's complications are even more severe than most. We will do our best, but please remember, the odds are not in our favor. On July 7th, at London's Royal Brompton Hospital, surrounded by a 20-strong team of medical personnel and a bank of beeping and blinking medical monitors, baby Dorothea was born by cesarean section. Velez, dressed in surgical scrubs, stood alongside Fenwick and peeked over a curtain to see his newborn daughter. "Look," he shouted, "she has a full head of hair." The team rushed Dorothea into a resuscitator unit and placed an oxygen mask on her tiny face. A priest Velez had asked to come along hurriedly baptized her as she was being scanned. As he left the operating room, Velez noticed a group of doctors looking at a screen that showed a sonogram of Dorothea's heart. Minutes later, the chief surgeon, Alan Fressay, told Velez, "I don't know how to explain this, but somehow there are 4 or 5 new veins in her heart that have appeared out of nowhere." He explained that these new veins, which no one had seen on earlier scans or MRIs, were helping drain her heart. In other words, they were keeping her alive. He sounded astonished. Dr. Michelon came out and hugged Velez. "She is stable and she is beautiful. Congratulations." The mood shifted dramatically on July 12th, when Velez and Fenwick met with Dr. Michelon and his team at the hospital to discuss the Norwood procedure operation scheduled for the next day. Velez sensed there was something wrong. The normally ebullient physician seemed distant and didn't make eye contact. The bad news was delivered by a hospital administrator. "We've decided that there is such a small chance your baby will survive the surgery that we cannot allow it to go forward." The room fell silent. Velez could feel his own heart beating. And if she did survive, the administrator continued, "There's a very good chance she would suffer irreversible brain damage." Velez looked over at Dr. Michelon for help. He was silent, looking down at the floor. The administrator said, "We recommend compassionate care." "You mean we should let her die?" said Velez curtly. "After we've come this far? You know I want to operate, but I cannot without the support of my team," said Dr. Michelon. Velez went into what he calls marine mode. "We're not going down like this," he told Fenwick. "Not after all we've been through." He went home and sent off blistering messages to the hospital CEO and the hospital attorney. One message demanded, "Who are you to play God?" He reached out to a well-known human rights lawyer who had a successful record fighting for NHS patients. Velez told Fenwick he was ready to chain himself to the Prime Minister's office on Downing Street if he had to. The pressure was on, he said. The U.S. 1st Marine Division had landed at Royal Brompton Hospital. 24 hours later, the hospital administrators relented. The operation would take place. At 7:30 the next morning, Dr. Michelon, assisted by three pediatric cardiac surgeons and a team of nurses, began the delicate open-heart surgery that would reconstruct the right ventricle of Dorothea's heart so that it would pump blood to both her body and her lungs without the need of the malformed left ventricle. After Dorothea's chest was opened, she was hooked up to a heart-lung machine that would temporarily take over for her heart and lungs while doctors operated on those organs. Surrounded by flickering monitors and the whirring of the heart-lung machine, Dr. Michelon began the intricate, precise procedure to build a new, larger aorta, the artery that carries blood from the heart to the rest of the body, by joining the pulmonary artery, which normally carries blood from the right ventricle to the lungs, to Dorothea's existing aorta. At less than 0.04 inches wide, it was unusually small. This time-consuming, painstaking work, because a baby's heart is only about the size of a walnut, and Dorothea's veins and arteries were so tiny, really a hair, says Dr. Michelon. He needed to wear high-powered magnifying lenses to see as he expertly cut and sewed her blood vessels together. The hours dragged by as the doctor and his team performed the delicate surgery. Their last step was to install a shunt from the right ventricle to the pulmonary artery, connecting them to direct the blood flow to the lungs. Nearly 11 hours after he and his team began, Dr. Michelon finally relaxed as he double-checked his work that had essentially replumbed the baby's faulty heart. By 4:30 p.m., Dr. Michelon, exhausted and still dressed in scrubs, found the parents in the waiting room. "Looks good," he told them, smiling broadly. "She is stabilized." The three embraced in a celebratory hug. Within minutes, Velez and Fenwick were startled by the screech of emergency alarms. A team of doctors and nurses rushed into the room where Dorothea was recovering from surgery. People screamed orders. A doctor yelled, "Cardiac arrest!" The alarm kept wailing. After a few minutes, a nurse dashed out to tell them, "Dorothea's heart has stopped. She's had a heart attack. We are trying to revive her." 10 minutes later, the nurse returned with the same message. 15 minutes later, she came back. "We're still doing CPR. We're trying to get her back." An hour later, Velez and Fenwick were ushered into the ICU. They were shocked to see their daughter tethered to a dialysis machine and a life support unit that helped her heart pump blood. Her chest was covered with dried blood and was swollen from more than an hour of CPR procedures. She was battered and bruised, but with the help of a bank of high-tech machines, she was still fighting to stay alive. Velez and Fenwick reached beneath the network of tubes and lines that were keeping Dorothea alive and held her hand. When Velez felt his daughter squeeze his index finger in her tiny hand, he told her, "You are a fighter. You did it. You're going to be okay." For the next 5 weeks, Velez and Fenwick rarely left Dorothea's side in the ICU. They talked to her, played music for her, and caressed her. On August 26th, Fenwick's birthday, doctors removed Dorothea's breathing tube and took her off the ventilator, moving her to only light-assisted breathing support from a CPAP machine. She would need a second open-heart operation in a few months, and doctors warned her parents that the next few weeks would be critical. To survive the upcoming surgery, Dorothea would need to put on weight and get stronger. The tiny girl moved out of intensive care and amazed the hospital staff by putting on more than 3 pounds in the next 2 months. Her reconstructed heart was working well, and her oxygen levels became normal. On September 14th, she was taken off the CPAP machine and began breathing on her own. On November 24th, Thanksgiving Day, Dr. Michelon performed the second surgery on her heart. He declared her prognosis excellent. She finally went home with her parents on December 21st, just in time for Christmas. She had defied the odds and lived up to her well-earned nickname, the Miracle Baby. Today, says her proud papa, she is a chubby, healthy baby and is constantly smiling and laughing. We sing happy birthday to her every morning because every day with her is a miracle. You know, right after we found out we were having a baby girl, we named her Dorothea. There was a good reason for that. He pauses and smiles as he watches Bathsheba, now 3 years old, snuggle up next to her baby sister on their living room couch. He continues, Dorothea is derived from a Greek phrase that means gift of God. And finally from Reader's Digest, here's Glad to Hear It, three stories to make your day. It was a terrifying scene. Smoke billowing from the Dog Resort, a canine daycare center in Seattle. More than 100 panicked pups were inside, looking for a way out. The fire department had yet to arrive, so employees and neighboring businesses took the lead. Workers at Hellbent Brewing Company cut a hole in the fence and led 35 dogs into their bar. A team from Classic Collision loaded a truck with 27 dogs and drove them to the repair offices. Other businesses, including a Mexican restaurant, pitched in as well. All 115 dogs survived the fire. As one rescuer told the Washington Post, "You know that Mr. Rogers saying, 'Look for the helpers'? That's how I felt. I didn't want to be the guy standing around watching. I wanted to be a helper." It turns out that we may not be going the way of the dinosaurs anytime soon. Last September, an asteroid called Dimorphos, roughly the size of the Great Pyramid, was threatening to ram a larger asteroid, Didymos. According to Fast Company magazine, researchers at NASA and the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory decided to see if they could mess with the asteroid's trajectory. They sent a golf cart-sized spacecraft hurtling at 14,000 miles per hour into Dimorphos. Success! The impact nudged it out of its orbit, giving Earth hope should it ever be threatened by a rogue rock. And every year, thousands of Americans are priced out of the costly medical equipment they need. Owen O'Neill, a nurse in Palm Beach, Florida, who witnessed the problem firsthand, has a solution. Give the equipment from patients who no longer need it to those who do. And thus, Clinics Can Help was born. Since its inception in the year 2005, the nonprofit has supplied more than 18,000 children and adults with everything from adaptive strollers to hospital beds. All donated. Zoe Vera, 8 years old, has cerebral palsy. Clinics Can Help supplied her with a wheelchair, an adaptive bicycle, and a beach wheelchair. O'Neill told People magazine, "There's no reason why people should struggle to get this equipment when it's so accessible." And let's sneak in a quick chuckle from Laughter, the Best Medicine. This from Luke Dunscombe of Plainfield, Indiana. Why do some people refuse to eat fresh grapes? They have their raisins. You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.